it's a 10-point game. Here's Porter across the timeline for the Badgers. Porter still going downhill. Porter accelerates to the rim and lays it up in it with the left hand. Nobody stopped Porter. Here's Myers, rainbow three, right side, pops out. Picked up McCray on the right baseline. McCray, hard move to the rim, tries to reverse layup, and it's up and in for McCray. Defended by Jones. High toss inside McCray. McCray spinning on Gardner, down low on the left, it's good, and a foul. Here's Williams on Betts, down low on the left, and she sticks it through. Off the backboard for two. That's 20 points for Williams. That's the 14th time this season that Williams has scored 20 or more in a game. And fighting for it is Hallie. She got her own rebound. Out to Leitzinger. Three. Good. By Leitzinger on the left. And there you go. Some of the highlights from tonight's Badgers game. Wisconsin will wrap up the regular season in Iowa City coming up on Sunday. Badgers and Hawkeyes will tip at 3 o'clock. It's a game you can hear locally in Madison on 1070 The Game, with the pregame show starting at 2:40 p.m. as the Badgers at now 4 wins, 4-13, take on the 9-8 Iowa Hawkeyes. I'd like to thank Kelly Freeman for her help engineering and producing tonight back in Jefferson City. I'm John Audius saying so long for the final time from the Kohl Center this season. Once again, that final score, second-ranked UCLA 91, Wisconsin 61. Thanks for listening to Wisconsin Women's Basketball.
Wisconsin Women's Basketball has been brought to you by Alliant Energy. Alliant Energy is powering beyond for you. And by UW Health Sports Medicine, treating the Badgers, treating you. The preceding has been a Learfield presentation of the Badger Sports Network.
Eagles head coach Nick Sirianni.
I think that the competition committee will do a good job of looking at everything. Just because it's a successful play for us doesn't mean that it should go away.
That's the Eagles' Nick Sirianni with Sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Folks, I'm talking with Jill Rosenthal. Trump is proposing to make incredibly drastic cuts to the NIH.
The National Institutes of Health, the state receives almost $600 million. That pays for over 7,000 jobs in Wisconsin and accounted for almost $1.5 billion in economic activity in 1 year.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Republicans home, taking a little beating. I thought it was interesting that the Republicans kicked off their press conference and addressed the viral protests at the town halls. Lisa McClain, Republican from Michigan, said Democrats are soliciting sob stories from bloated bureaucrats with six-figure salaries. Give me a break. And this is the image, this is what they're trying to paint, that everyone in the federal government makes six figures. They're all sitting around in corner offices doing nothing. And it's you, the hardworking folks out there, you know, sweating, the beads of sweat running off of you. And you have to justify, when the reality is you look at most, you know, government jobs, nowhere near six figures. But that's not the narrative they want to keep throwing at you. They want to keep throwing the Elon Musk nonsense so that, again, you can defide people. I can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. You throw this red meat out there to keep people pitted against each other. This is where we get. Now, I find it interesting watching Speaker Johnson during his interview on Tuesday kind of brushing off Elon Musk and some of the stuff going on there. I'm telling you, there's going to be some interesting days ahead, because you've got a number of conservatives who are threatening to tank their budget resolution. A couple of the far out ones like Thomas Massie from Kentucky, that Burchett from Tennessee. There's a number of them that, you know, when you've got a 218, a 215, you got that much room. And understand what they're talking about doing. The massive cuts that they're talking about are going to hurt average, everyday working people. And in fact, it's going to redistribute wealth in this country in a fairly substantial way, because states are going to get stuck picking up with what they're cutting, especially on the Medicaid front. Now remember, they claimed they weren't going to cutting no Medicaid, but the Congressional Budget Office is saying, you can't get anywhere near the numbers that Republicans are throwing out without touching Medicaid. So what is it? I do find it interesting, however, that most of what Elon Musk and the Doge ferrets have come up with, most of the wall of receipts, if you will, and the canceling of federal contracts. In fact, EPI came out with the AP came out with a story and said 40% of the contracts that Musk canceled have zero savings. Nothing. There is nothing being saved. And you could argue that some of them are going to be much more costly down the road. And a number of them just flat out and out lies. They were talking about an $8 billion cut at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. The actual contract that they cut was not $8 billion. It was $8 million. I know it's only zeros and it's only three zeros, but when it's in front of the decimal point, that matters. Matters a lot. And you would think Musk would know that. So either he's not that smart or he's lying. It's one or the other. Now, the massive cuts, the massive savings we were going to save from destroying the U.S. Agency for International Development, the USAID, they had said they had found three cuts worth $655 million apiece. Well, no, it was one. And then when they went down and they actually ferreted down, when someone actually looked into it, turns out not $655 million three times, not $655 million two times, not even $655 million once, but about $18 million. Now you go, Rick, that's a lot of money. And it is a lot of money. But what's it going to cost down the road? There's also talk of a $232 million cut at Social Security. Yeah, a $232 million cut to granny Social Security. According to reports, Mr. Musk's organization appeared to have mistakenly believed that the agency had canceled a huge information technology contract with a defense contractor. Instead, it had canceled only a tiny portion of it, or about 560,000 of the program. Not 232 million, but 560,000. Again, still some money, but nowhere near. So what this means is you're not getting your $5,000 Doge check. It's not happening. Now I'm waiting for them to say, hey, we're going to privatize the immigration. We're going to privatize ICE. We're going to hand it over to the Blackwater people, because evidently there's talk of letting Eric Prince and Blackwater and these international mercenaries go round up the undocumented for about $25 billion. And I guarantee you they're going to claim it was going to cost us $350 billion to have government do it. We can get mercenaries to come do it for $25 billion. And we won't have to deal with any of that messy legal stuff. You ready? You ready for the fun and the entertainment that this kind of crazy thinking is going to bring us? Yeah. Democrats, get ready. Please, please have some ideas for the future. Please, when we regain the reins of power, have a direction on where you want to go. Seems rational to me. But I want to hear your thoughts. Does this sound like fun and entertainment to you? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. When we come back, Christian Weller is going to be here to share some thoughts on his idea of baby bonds. How can we help with income inequality, especially with the racial divide? And how can we shore up families' ability to succeed as they grow older? This might be an idea. Democrats, pay attention. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I've been saying, look, the reality is Democrats, stay out of D.C. Leave immediately. Get into those red districts. Hold those hearings. Come up with a plan, a vision, a message. Where will you take the country once you get your hands back on the reins? What direction should we go? What solutions do we have to our problems? And look, there are a lot of problems out there. Go find them. Come up with solutions. And that's why I've asked my next guest to come share some thoughts. Because, again, we talk about wealth inequality. We talk about the racial wealth divide. We talk about all those things. But what solutions do you have other than pointing your finger? That's why I've asked Christian Weller to come share some thoughts. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, also a professor of public policy at the McCormick Graduate School for Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston. Christian, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you very much, Rick, for having me.
So you guys have got this idea of baby bonds. Is this a new thing?
No, baby bonds, the idea has been around for about 20 years, roughly speaking. It was developed or publicized by Sandy Darity at Duke University and Derek Hamilton, who's now at the New School University. And the idea is that a government entity, and we make the point that this doesn't have to be the federal government, that you can have this at a local government, at a state government, would put money into an account for a newborn. The original idea envisioned that the federal government would pay $1,000 roughly every year until a kid turns 18, which is a substantial amount of money. State and local governments don't have the same amount of resources. There, the idea is more like a baby bonus. The baby is born and you get somewhere between $2,000 and $4,000 is when the baby is born into an account. And when the kid turns 18, the money then can be spent for a number of reasons. The reason why we've talked about it, and there's a number of really important things to know about it. It is a crucial wealth building measure because the money is locked up for 18 years. So people actually do have a leg up when they turn 18 to start a business, buy a house, go to college, whatever. The other part is, in terms of estimates, it is, as far as we can tell, meaning my colleagues at the Center for American Progress and others, it is the single most important step towards closing the racial, especially the black-white wealth gap. There's different forms of this, but it's a single thing we can do to close the gap. It is very well targeted towards those who do not have wealth, that those tend to be more likely African-Americans, Latinos, but a white household that doesn't have money would also qualify for it. And I think that's important to remember, that this is sort of giving everybody a shot at economic security and economic opportunity.
Well, at $2,000 at birth, what are we talking at 18? You know, how is that going to close that gap? What would that be at 18? Would that be enough to pay for college? You said start a business, buy a house. Yeah. I don't know. $2,000 is not going to get you to buy a house.
You start off with $2,000, right? As I said, like you start off when the baby's born at $2,000 or $4,000, and over 18 years that grows to about $5,000 to $8,500. That's not nothing. If you compare this, what people actually have in liquid reserves for Black and Latino households, they have. Young households have about $2,000 in reserves. So what this does is, yes, it allows you to make a down payment on something, starting a business, taking some time off, going to college. But also, and I think we underestimate this, it gives you peace of mind. So when you're 18, it allows you to experiment, say like, well, maybe I'll take a year off job, do some odd jobs and see what I really want before I take the plunge to go into college. Or I'll leave the money in the account, wait for a few years, go to college, and then it gives you the freedom to say, let me try something. I don't have to take the first job offer that comes along. I have some freedom for a few months, half a year, to move in with some buddies and try something that seems fun, risky. I just had this conversation with a friend of mine where the son says, look, I got a master's in political science, but I would like to do some music. And so he's now touring with his band and see whether he can make money. If he can't, he'll use his master's and do something else. But that kind of freedom is really important. And that kind of freedom matters for economic dynamics because it doesn't tie people right to the first chances and say, like, here's the first job. You need to do this. And you need to do this for the rest of your life. It gives you that peace of mind.
I get that. You know, to use your example, though, I mean, the person that you're talking about, you know, this is giving them the opportunity to try something else. They still had something to fall back on. I think of myself, you know, growing up. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. At 18, my grandfather said, there's the door. Good luck. Call your grandmother. I would have taken that money and I would have, you know, it would have been just, you know, a couple extra months rent. It would have been, you know, something I would have squandered. It wouldn't have been, you know, these higher, loftier aspirations. Is that something we're concerned about?
No, like some governments do, but not me personally. I think we can't really test the counterfactual with you, Rick, but and go on, we don't have a time machine and we don't sure. know what would have happened to the Rick Smith if he had $5,000. But in most cases, I think what people will do is, yes, they will explore things a little bit differently, but they will also breathe easier and say like, look, let me take a few months to think about, try something out. And I think generally what we find is that people aren't, they're not great with money. I don't want to say that, but I don't want to overstate this. But most people sort of can handle money relatively well. They sort of know how to balance things between like spending money right now and keeping some in the bank, especially in case of an emergency. And emergencies, the one emergency we always think about is your car breaking down and you no longer being able to get to your job, which is a very American phenomenon, right? But like you have $5,000, you no longer have to worry about this. Yeah. You know you're going to get to your job and be able to replace
No, in fact, car. In fact, car repairs are the number one reason people are homeless. Yes. I found that to be amazing, but that is, it begins that snowball that ends up making people, especially people who are on the edge, homeless.
Because it's just, if your car breaks down, right, you no longer can get to your job. You got to remember, 80% of Americans drive themselves to work. So, because your job is not right next door. We are a car-centric society. So, if your car breaks down, you no longer get to your work. But you also can't shop around. Maybe the supermarket is 2 miles down the road. You now have to pay twice as much at the local bodega, right? So like, because you cannot drive there. So like that part, but what I really want to emphasize is that this phenomenon of peace of mind really matters. Like one of my arguments, why we saw such a massive disconnect between the economic performance in the last 2 years and the people's feelings about the economy was that in 2021, people had gotten the stimulus checks, they had the child tax credit checks, they actually had money in the bank. And they took a breather and said like, wow, this is what it feels like if we have basic financial security. And then inflation came up and eroded that, and the money went away. And people were angry, rightfully, about this, that all of a sudden they had to be at the whims of their employers. Will I get my paycheck? Will I get the increase? Will I find a new job? Will my car hold up and bring me to work, right? And I think that sort of pendulum swing drove a lot of the dissatisfaction. The bottom line is, we, as economists in the economic policy realm, we've talked a lot about how can we make sure people have money to pay their bills, like the income, right? How can we reduce that? What we have ignored for a long time is we need to figure out whether there is money in the checkbook, there is in the checking account, that if something goes wrong, can people pay whatever that is? And again, the example, as we just discussed, is your car breaking down. And there is evidence, Mike Matowitz and I wrote about this, that when people use their stimulus checks, they were asked in a survey, do you use your stimulus checks to pay your bills or save money? The people who saved their money were much more likely to see an improvement in their mental health than the ones who said, I'm going to use it to pay my for my car and groceries or whatever. So there is something there. This whole peace of mind matters so much for so many people. And baby bonds is one way to get there.
No, no, look, I agree with you. It's one of those things that, you know, I'm fortunate in my situation now, after, you know, having a union job for as long as I've had and having small businesses that I've run, I have that kind of security. In fact, I'm fortunate for it for right now, given the situation that I'm in personally, that we've been able to weather a massive storm because I've had savings in that. And I think that's a great thing to want for society, and also maybe to teach a little bit about how to use money better. You know, it's one of these things that I tell my kids, I wish I would have known at 15 or 14 when I got my first job to put money into an IRA like we've done for our kids. So the more that you understand how to use money and how it grows, the better it is for closing that inequality gap, I think. So the education part of this could be really exciting as well.
I hate to disagree with you. I'm not a big fan on the financial education part, because okay. I think part of it is just the world of finance is extremely complicated and unnecessarily complex. And sort of telling a 15, 16-year-old what an IRA is, by the time they actually have some money, they've forgotten about it. But I think what matters is...
I'm hoping they forget about the IRA money.
So, but I think part of it, like what happens is that families actually do talk about money and how the importance is in balancing the checkbook. And I think people do this at the dinner table or whatever, when they run out the door, it doesn't matter. So like, I have to go here and the numbers don't add up. And I think people understand this, especially among Black households and Latino households, because money is very tight in many communities and subparts of the Asian community, rural white communities. I think people sort of understand the value of money. But there is, I think, we, from a policy perspective, have ignored, and I count myself in that, this desire, this need to have some cushion, and it doesn't actually be that have to be that large, some cushion in case something goes wrong.
Yeah.
Like for a while, there was like some of my colleagues would mock this, like, oh, what does it really mean if a person lives one paycheck away from disaster? It's like, it means they have to have some money, probably a few thousand dollars in their savings or checking account to weather whatever storm it is. And it doesn't have to be super large to begin with. And I think that's my hope, is that we're going to shift the focus and policy somewhat. We broaden it. I think it's important to raise incomes. We need to have good jobs for everybody. That means higher wages, unionization, good benefits, and so on and so forth. But we also need to make sure that people have some money in the bank. And right now, the way we do this, the way we design savings policy, we help millionaires to build more wealth. We do not help working families to build more wealth.
No, I think back to when I got my first union job. Old timer took me aside and said, look, kid, before you start spending this big money, 6 months of bills in a tin can and a sock under your mattress and a bank, whatever, but always have 6 months of bills set aside in case you, and his rationale was, in case you need to walk across that threshold and go out on strike to protect the wages and benefits and the conditions that you have here. That to me seems like good advice, and I'm fortunate that I took it. Not everyone, unfortunately, can do that. So this, your argument is moving us toward some of that bit of security.
Right, and part of it, I think, is important to what you just said. I think sort of panning out, you had the opportunity to do this because you had a good job and because somebody took you aside. For a lot of people, unionization is below 10% in the private sector. So like a lot of people don't have good jobs, and then they don't get the advice. But I think primarily it's the, I don't have a good job. That not only is it doesn't pay well, but I might be unemployed tomorrow. Like there's a lot of fluctuations, and that's particularly true for Latino workers, many Asian Americans, right? There is sort of a very large racial divide when it comes to job security, job stability. And what that in the end means, a lot of people never get the opportunity to build that wealth. They don't have the resources. Even if they build like $500, they constantly have to dip into it because something goes wrong. And what we're saying is, we know that that's happening. We need to, like, we can't design social policy for everything, especially not in the current world where Republicans want to gut any social insurance, including Social Security and stuff like that. So what we need to focus on is, what can governments, and again, it would be great if the federal government would do it, not going to happen anytime soon. What can state and local governments do to help build wealth? And baby bonds is one thing that all levels of governments are looking at, are proposing, have money for, and are putting forward.
Well, it doesn't sound like a bad idea to me, but if I remember right, this was a fairly conservative idea not too long ago. I thought the Heritage Foundation or someone came out with something similar to this. And, so there's it gives me hope that maybe that's accurate, and that maybe this is something that could pass. Because, look, I think you do want to level the playing field a little bit. I do think you want consumers to have access to capital to be able to participate in the economy. There's a whole bunch of reasons. It seems like common sense almost.
You would think so. I testified in favor of the Montgomery County in Maryland bill by Representative Council Member Jawando. And the conservatives there were opposed to it. This is largely because they want the money for tax cuts.
Yeah,
there is sort of like, if a Democrat is for it, a Republican has to be against it, rather than finding a common sense solution. And that is unfortunately happening even at the local level. Yes, this should be something that conservatives should be in favor of, because it moves a lot of control back to individuals. And it has to, because, as I said, we're not going to be able to expand social insurance, but we also can't define social insurance for everything, right? There can't be we're not going to propose a social insurance programs for broken cars. So there has to be some room for private savings. And I think part of it is to recognize that we can throw whatever financial education we want at 15-year-olds. It's not going to fix the fundamentals of people not being able to save enough money. But we do know what works, and that is some government incentives. In the baby bonds, it's, we give it to parents, we give it to children. It's actually in a trust account. Children won't have access, family won't have access until the children are 18. But there's a number of other things we can do to help people build savings. And the main thing we know works is, if somebody says, I'm gonna save 50 cents, the government says, I'm gonna give you $1.50 on top for low-income people, or $1 for middle-income families.
Yeah,
that works. That does wonders for financial savings, for long-term planning, for people's mental health. It really is amazing how well that works.
Yeah, we know how to end poverty. we give people money. It seems simple. We know how to end childhood hunger. We give them food. It seems pretty simple. This seems pretty logical as well.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like when we talk about sort of, is this a question, can poor people handle money? Yes, they can handle money. Think about sort of what it takes when you're poor to apply to all the various programs that are available, be that SSI, SNAP, the food stamps, housing vouchers. You have to stand in line. You have this whole bureaucracy you got to struggle with to get access to all of that. People know how to do this. They know how to manage it. And then they have to budget it for the rest of the month. They're really good at handling money. So why not give them just money? But that's part of like helping them pay for what they need right now. The other part in that same argument goes, give them some money for the future. And they will know. People will know what to do with that. And the government has no business to telling them what to use it for.
There you go. Christian, I appreciate the time. Great idea. It'll be interesting to see where this goes. But thanks so much.
Stay tuned what happens at the state and local level. Lots of stuff happening there.
Good. Look forward to it. Christian Weller, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. I want to hear your thoughts. Is this a good idea? Would this be something that you would support? Or do you see this as something that would divide us even further? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Back after this.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Increasing clouds tonight, maybe a sprinkle or flurry, low in the low 30s. For tomorrow, a clearing sky by the afternoon and warmer again, highs low 40s. Windy with maybe some sprinkles Friday, high upper 40s to 50, currently 40 degrees.
The Todd Alba Show.
Elon Musk putting in so much money that it drowns out other people's voices to decide who our next Supreme Court justice is. Whether or not you're going to vote Republican or Democrat or Schimmel or Crawford, your voice is getting drowned out by Elon Musk, a guy who has no business in Wisconsin. And you don't think that Brad Schimmel is going to be in Elon Musk's pocket? It's going to affect us in Wisconsin.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, union approval ratings are at an all-time high, while simultaneously union density at its lowest point in my lifetime. Look, yeah, the reality is workers want to join and form unions. The messaging is there. And you go, how's that possible? How's it possible that so many people want to be union members who want good wages, benefits, all of that stuff, and yet can't seem to get there? And you could argue it's ossified labor laws. You could argue it's employers willing to break the law, a media structure who's done nothing but continually badmouth unions. Could be all of that stuff and more. The question is how do you move forward? How do we use today's technology to organize, to train, to get people fighting for those better wages, hours, and conditions? My next guest is a professor of labor studies at Rutgers University. He's the co-founder of and organizing trainer for the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee, author of the Substack page, Labor Politics. And if that weren't enough, he is the author of a new book, We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. Eric Blanc, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So let's start right at the very beginning. You know, here we are. We're in an environment, as I said, labor has an approval rating that has not been at this rate in decades. Yet, you know, the other end of the spectrum, not a lot of members. First, how did we get here?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that everything you said is true. It's also the case that over the last couple of years, you've had, in some ways, for recent experience, record numbers of workers joining unions. So last year, you had over 100,000 workers unionized. The year before, almost the same amount, just a little bit less the year before. So you're talking about not insignificant numbers of workers organizing themselves into unions just in the last 3 years alone. It hasn't been enough to turn around union density for a variety of reasons. Part of that just has to do with the economy. Industrialized union jobs are on the way out, and the new jobs that are created oftentimes tend to be in the service sector, non-union jobs. And so you're playing catch up. So even if you organize a lot of workers, the overall union density is stagnant or slightly declining because of changes in the economy. So until there's a big breakthrough in the service sector, you're not going to start seeing the numbers decline. But the big condition, you know, for all of this has been that all of the things you mentioned, employer opposition, broken labor law, XYZ, we know those things. I would argue, and what I do try to show in the book is part of the problems is unions themselves, though, that unions themselves haven't been investing enough in new organizing. And in particular, they haven't been investing in the type of organizing that can scale, that could potentially organize tens of millions of workers, because that's what we're going to need. We're going to need tens of millions of new workers in unions. And the dominant organizing models are just too costly, too much staff, takes too long to be able to organize the types of mass scale campaigns necessary to turn things around.
So your argument, if I get this right, is we're still using 1930s models in the technology age.
Yeah, to a certain extent. And you know, if anything, I wish we were doing a better job of taking the best of the 1930s. I would say we're using like 1989 models. So it's sort of the worst of both worlds. We're neither using the technology nor are we leaning on the bottom up sort of worker grassroots dynamics that in part drove forward the 1930s.
No, I'm glad you put it that way, because, you know, I was going to ask you, what is this concept that you have of worker to worker unionism, and how and why is it different than the model of the 30s?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a good question. In the 1930s, first of all, the political economy was different, so you could focus on a few really big factories around which, you know, every town revolved. But I would say the big difference is that the working class is much more atomized today. It's much more spread out. So, you know, people don't go to the same churches and bars and sort of community groups they used to. So it takes a lot more to foster unionization. And when you have one union win, it doesn't spread as organically as it used to, because you don't have this sort of pre-existing culture of working class life through which this stuff could organically spread. So you have to foster it a lot more than you had to do in the 1930s. One of the things that makes worker-to-worker organizing different than the type of grassroots organizing that was dominant in the 1930s is that now workers can connect with workers all across the country using digital tools. So in many ways, I do think that the model I'm arguing for is very similar to the worker-led model of the 1930s, in which workers themselves were taking on so many of the tasks that in recent years have tended to fall to staff, whether it's strategizing, whether it's initiating campaigns, whether it's training other people. In the 1930s, though, that could only happen on a local level, just for basic technological reasons. Whereas now, because of digital tools, if a worker, for instance, look at the Starbucks campaign. The Starbucks campaign, they won an election in Buffalo, New York in late 2021. Listeners might remember this. All of a sudden, they got inundated with requests all across the country from baristas saying, well, how did you do what you did? We want to participate. If this had been the 1930s, there would have been no way to connect. They just wouldn't have been able to organize a national campaign. Or if it had been a staff-intensive campaign, they wouldn't have been able to go national because they just didn't have the staff necessary to, you know, to field all these calls. So what they did instead is they had workers themselves jump on Zoom to train up baristas all across the country and how they organize their own shop. So that's how it sort of spread virally. You have workers training workers, supporting other workers, using digital tools to go big and to self-organize in a way that wasn't possible even 10 years ago, frankly.
Yeah, you know, I've been saying for years, if you know, every generation has to rediscover the concept of solidarity and what it means to them and then act on them. And this is kind of that. This is people saying, hey, there's a way forward. There's a way to make lives better, and rediscovering, you know, old tools, I guess, right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
So, you know, again, I go back to how you've made this sound very simple. You know, just going to get on a Zoom call and we're going to do this stuff. If that's the case, you know, why aren't unions doing this? I mean, there are a lot of ideas that are floating around out there. There's on how we're going to revitalize the labor movement. This seems fairly simple. Just a bunch of people going to get together. Are there unions doing this? And if they're not, why?
Well, there are a growing number of unions doing it. And so that's, you know, in many ways what the book is about, is trying to look at the unions that are doing this and say, hey, the rest of the labor movement, this is a model you can adopt. So it's not just Starbucks Workers United. It's also the United Auto Workers are pursuing a very similar model. You can look at the News Guild, which has won hundreds of first contracts all across media and journalism. You can look at the drives in higher education that United Electrical Workers Union is pursuing. And so, yeah, you can see in a wide variety of industries, these same basic techniques are being used. And I don't think it's just the case people jump on a Zoom call and have, you know, and it just sort of happens spontaneously. A lot of training and resources have gone into this. You know, they've had to build up structures so that you have mass training calls in which you're training workers in all of the classic techniques of organizing. It's not just sort of unleash the floodlights and hope it works out. It takes a lot of actually structure and strategy and tactics to build up a space for workers to be able to take leadership. It doesn't happen just sort of automatically. You do need to train up workers in the best organizing methods and strategy and in giving a space for them to be able to spread this nationally. So I do think actually that you need unions and established resources to make this happen. The argument of the book, though, is that the resources and staff of unions can be leveraged in a far more scalable way. And I think more unions are moving in this direction. Frankly, the fact that more aren't is that most unions aren't doing new organizing, period. It's not as if most unions are like trying to experiment with all the best ways to bring in new members. The vast majority of union locals don't try to grow. The vast majority of national unions spend 5 to 10% of their budget on growth. So, you know, the reality is there's just not enough discussion about what techniques is required to win.
Yeah, but ultimately, isn't this a cultural thing? I mean, you know, I go back to, and I think about my grandparents' generation. Even people who weren't members of unions saw the value of workers being in unions. In fact, you know, you go back to the, you know, the 40s and the 50s, you know, every industry had a union, you know, whether they were waitresses and waiters, whether they were, you know, telephone operators or movie theater ticket takers. You go down the list, and, you know, insurance agents had unions. It was a cultural thing. Isn't that kind of what you're talking about, more than just, you know, simple worker-to-worker organizing? Is this a cultural thing of what you're proposing?
Yeah, I mean, I think any serious organizing effort and any serious labor movement always is deeply cultural, right? It always changes the way people interact with their coworkers and their communities. I would push back a little, though, to say, you know, it's true what you describe if you're talking about the 1940s or 50s, but what about if you go to the 1910s and 20s before the labor movement had unionized all these, you know, companies? In those contexts, people wanted unions, but they didn't have them yet. So I'm not sure the culture, was it that the culture shifted so dramatically from the 1910s and 20s to the 1940s? I think it was just more that that culture of supporting unions eventually crystallized into organizing that overcame the opposition of the bosses. And I think we have a similar thing today. The culture is there, actually, as you mentioned at the start. People support unions. People want to be members of unions. It's a question of how do you build the organized power to overcome the opposition of corporations. And once you overcome that, then it's a mopping up operation. You know, that's when you're going to see union density numbers increase, because once you've defeated the companies, then it's very easy to sort of organize hundreds of thousands of workers, and, you know, because the companies stop putting up a war of resistance every single time.
Yeah, but if you're going to use the comparison of the 10s and the 20s, you know, it was basically illegal to join unions at that point. And, you know, you got fired for doing it, as opposed to the 40s and 50s, where you're now living under the NLRA.
Yeah, no, that's right. But that's, in some ways, we've returned to that situation. I mean, particularly under Trump, but just more generally, labor law is barely enforced today, right? So, you know, think about Starbucks. Starbucks had hundreds of workers were fired for trying to unionize their shop. So even though you have on paper labor law now, which is good, and, you know, it's a step forward, the reality is the fear factor is still very high, in a way, many ways similar to the way it was in the 1910s and 1920s.
Yeah, now we're seeing an opportunity, I think, for labor as Musk and Donald Trump are overreaching, as we all knew they would, and especially in the federal workforce. I've got, you know, friends who are who are with the various federal unions who are saying, you know, people are coming back in droves. It's these kind of crises, this kind of overreach that is an opportunity for unions and for workers to organize. Are you seeing anything?
Yeah, I mean, we've already seen a major upsurge in union membership, for instance, in the federal sector. AFGE, the major national federal workers union, has had over 15,000 workers join in the last 5 weeks, which is more than joined in the entire year prior. Right. So workers are surging into those unions because oftentimes the boss, we say, is the best organizer. Exactly as you describe it, sort of the insanity of Musk and Trump's attacks, just the sledgehammer they're wielding against the federal government, the federal workforce, has created a crisis. And it obliges people who, you know, otherwise, frankly, wanted to keep their heads down. The civil servants are not a part of the workforce known for sort of risk taking. But what do you do when you have someone like Elon Musk threatening to fire you if you don't respond within 48 hours to his email. It obliges a level of resistance that I think workers are starting to stand up to. And I do think it's wildly unpopular. All of the polls across the board are showing that people do not like what Musk is doing. They do not like what Trump is doing. And they're really playing with fire because unions are very powerful. And Trump did not get elected to start union busting. He did not get elected with a mandate to start cutting people's Medicaid, you know, and putting their data and Social Security at risk. And so I do think that there's a huge amount of overreach and that we're already starting to see the backlash. And if you read the sort of between the lines, a lot of congressional Republicans are freaking out now because their own Republican constituents are saying, what is going on? Like, what is this? It's going to be a bloodbath in the next election if you keep up with this.
No, and as you said, look, the unions are very powerful because a lot of union members voted for Donald Trump and vote for Republicans. And everything that we talked about in the run-up to the campaign, Musk and Trump are actually doing, you know, most of what came out of Project 2025, the discussions of firing workers that we had for the year before, they're actually doing. And as you've said, you know, it's one of the best organizing tools.
Yeah. And so I'm excited by seeing what the federal workers are up to. I think that the stakes of what they're doing couldn't be any higher. If Trump and Musk are able to destroy the federal workforce, destroy federal services, then that's going to set the basis for them to have sort of full authoritarian control over the government and to be able to impose their agenda across all of society. But I actually think they're going to lose. I think there's going to be continued and escalating backlash from community members and from federal workers saying, no, we're not going to let you destroy these things that, you know, hundreds of thousands of people have built up over the last century that, you know, millions of Americans depend on. And so I would just say for any of your listeners who are interested to figure out how they can get involved, whether they're a federal worker or if they're a community member interested in supporting federal workers, there's an easy sign-up form to get updates about local actions around federal workers. And so that website is go.savepublicservices.com, go.savepublicservices.com. And if you just go there, sign up, then they'll let you know about local actions you can take in your town to support federal workers and federal services.
So this is, you know, what you're talking about, using the tools of technology of today to bring people, and maybe not even federal workers, but you know, just interested parties like me who want to know what's going on. Because I look at what's happening to the federal workforce, and this is the kind of stuff, if you allow workers like this to be treated this way, that old injury to one being an injury to all, this eventually trickles down and affects all of us, doesn't it?
Yeah, and there's a real danger that the labor movement as a whole underestimates the importance of defending these federal workers right now. And the best analogy we have is, I think about the last time there was a major attack on federal workers, and that was 1981 with the PATCO strike. So these were federal, you know, air traffic controllers are federal workers. They went on strike in 1981. Reagan fired them, and that unleashed a boss's offensive across all industries. It wasn't just the sort of federal workers who were impacted. It was all workers who were impacted by the bosses saying, oh, wow, if Reagan sort of gives us the green light, this is what we can do. And we're going to see that again. If Musk is able to just terrorize federal employees and say, basically, accept every one of my whims. And if you don't, then you're out. And then everyone who stays on has to do double the work for the same pay. Well, why wouldn't every company do that, right? And they're going to do that unless labor puts up enough of a fight that other companies see, oh, well, you know, this is, if we try to go down the Musk route, we're going to have you know, a crisis on our hands.
No, and this takes us back to the history, doesn't it? I mean, I think about my grandparents' generation. They came back from fighting World War II to fight fascism on the shop floor. They were literally tearing this country apart brick by brick, and the NLRA was the peace treaty that kind of made it all better for a little while. It now appears, and maybe you've got a different thought, that that's going to go by the wayside at some point in the near future as Musk and Bezos and the rest of them are challenging the constitutionality of a law that's, what, 80 years old? Interesting times.
Yeah, we don't know what's going to happen with the NLRA. I think there's all sorts of possibilities that they keep it on the books and just sort of have a relatively narrow reading in some of these lawsuits. I would be surprised if they overturn it, because that would in turn create space for states to pass good labor law legislation that would be enforceable. So it opened a huge can of worms for the employer class if you all of a sudden you get rid of the NLRA completely. So we'll see what happens. But I what we do know is that no matter what the legal terrain is, workers have to fight back, and they can fight back and win even in their very inhospitable regimes. And the example I think of when, you know, we're thinking about, well, what could it look like, is the red state teacher strikes of 2018. Listeners might remember West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona. You had statewide strikes of hundreds of thousands of educators, even though strikes were illegal, even though the unions were very weak, right to work states, Republican governors. And nevertheless, the workers won by striking, by calling on the community to support them. And they forced these Republican governments to give them what they wanted. So it shows you that even when the government is against you, if you have enough power from below, if you have enough community support, you can still win.
The book, We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big, written by Eric Blanc. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at this. Last question I've got for you. What kind of reviews are you getting? What kind of reaction are you getting from the big book, We Are the Union?
Yeah, the reaction has been great. I mean, it's been really sort of heartening to hear about how many unions are reaching out. Literally every day I get another email from a union saying, hey, can we meet up? I want to hear about what they're doing. And then additionally, it's sort of proof of concept, because right now the federal workers unionists, who I'm sort of helping support a bit behind the scenes, are also using these techniques. And so you can see it sort of in live action, as it were, this model being used to hopefully defeat Trump.
Outstanding stuff. Eric, I appreciate you taking time. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Eric Blanc. Again, the book, We Are the Union. Make sure you take a look at this wherever you get your books. How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 2011. That was the day the labor movement took an historic stand in Madison, Wisconsin. That cold Saturday, a crowd of union members and supporters swelled to more than 100,000 people at the state capitol building. The protesters were there to march, sing, chant, and stand defiant against anti-union legislation proposed by Wisconsin's Republican Governor Scott Walker. Known as Act 10, the legislation aimed to slash union rights of public sector workers. The protests at the Capitol had begun with a small crowd on Valentine's Day. Nearly 2 weeks later, historian Stuart Levington called the protests the biggest crowds in Madison's history. As protesters marched, famous supporters and labor leaders gave speeches. Peter Yarrow of the musical group Peter, Paul, and Mary exhorted to the crowd, "The eyes of the world are on you." And he was right. Media coverage of the massive protests dominated news channels. Labor was taking a stand. Yet despite the massive protest, the Wisconsin Republicans had a supermajority in the legislature to pass their anti-union attacks. Since 2011, they have expanded their attacks to the private sector as well, passing a statewide right-to-work law. The impact has been devastating to working people in Wisconsin. Public sector workers have had to pay more for health care and retirement, losing 10% of their real wages. Governor Walker had promised to create a quarter of a million new jobs during his first term. He could not even deliver half that amount. By the summer of 2015, Wisconsin median family income growth ranked 50th in the nation. Those who marched in Madison could see these dark days coming. What will it take to stop these attacks on working people?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the book, We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. Highly suggested, written by Eric Blanc. Good stuff. And look, this, not new. The idea of workers talking to each other, self-organizing. Something that my grandparents' generation and before, look, basic organizing, talking to people and using today's technology to do it, kind of a big thing. Now, interestingly enough, the White House announced on Tuesday that, we're not going to have any independent group of journalists determine who gets access to the White House, to Air Force One, to anything. The White House will decide which journalists meet their criteria. Again, seems fairly fascistic, saying, independent media, no, you sycophants, we want, you better be in line, You better do what you're told, AP. You better call it the Gulf of America, or you don't get access. This is who these people are. And so when I saw the story, you know, President Trump took more than 1,000 questions last month. That's more than 30 a day. That's more than, you know, Joe Biden took, you know, and he only took, you know, 141 questions in his first month. President Biden didn't take questions. And you go, yeah, he didn't. Struggled getting the words out. Unlike Trump, who never seems to be lost for nonsense words and has a media that does not, that doesn't really hold him accountable. I mean, the fact that Trump has said, look, you folks who I don't agree with, you're not getting access. We're not letting you in. And that any journalist shows up after that is quite amazing to me. Because what should happen in that environment, because understand, our media, you know, the press, the Fourth Estate, they have some pretty awesome powers, constitutionally protected. They should protect their industry by going, look, if you're not going to let, you know, our colleagues in, we're not coming in. We're not going to report what you've got to say unless everyone has access. But we know that's not going to happen. And what we're going to get is, sure, Trump's going to take 1,000 questions over a month. If you've got people going, oh, President Trump, how wonderful are you? You know, I'm sorry. Do you love dogs and puppies? Never going to ask a tough question. And the ones that if someone does ask a tough question, Trump just tears into the person, makes it personal, and the question never gets answered. Unlike when they would go after Biden, very different. And this is where the fact that the right wing has built a massive media empire, the billionaire class in this country owns our media structure, and then we're shocked that the media treats people differently. And, you know, I look at talking with Eric Blanc here a minute ago. You know, the fact that, you know, for me, I love the fact that worker-to-worker organizing is something that he's pitching. I love the fact that, you know, grassroots, ground up. I love the fact that, you know, pick up the ball and run with it. I love the cultural aspect of it. But that takes some bit of media, some bit of information that the right has done a masterful job of inoculating against. You know, and I've told stories before. You know, I think of the woman who works the local supermarket, complaining about how low her wages are, or how she has no benefits, how they keep cutting her hours, how they treat her poorly. You know, all of this stuff. And I say, you know, I said, yeah, that's why you unionize. Yeah, we don't need no union. No. They just want our dues dollars. And you go right there is the definition of inoculation. They have closed this woman's mind to the reality that fighting for better wages, hours, and conditions in a contract would make her life better. That's why I think these kind of stories and the kind of books, the kind of book like Eric has written is so important in this moment. Because there's going to be a time, and as we talked about this, the federal employees are being treated horribly. There's going to be a moment for all of us to take a stand. The old labor frame, an injury to one being an injury to all, as we watch the federal workforce being abused, terrorized. Understand, you are next. You know, I had someone email me, but, you know, Rick, I got to justify what I do. Yeah, and so do federal workers in the chain of command. That every worker has someone they answer to, and the federal workforce does too. What Elon wants you to think is there's nobody paying attention. They just come in and sit and do nothing. They don't know what they do. No, they shouldn't have to answer to someone who, I don't know who Elon's supposed to be. Is he the king? Do we have to answer to King Elon? Answer, evidently in his mind, yes. Be very wary, very wary. Want to hear your thoughts, though? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You think we're in that moment? You think there's a chance of pulling together, finding solidarity in each other, and obviously some aid and comfort as well as the suffering continues? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Grab the podcast, freespeech.org, to check out the video. As always, love having you here. Thanks so much. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The Trump administration dropping lawsuits the Biden administration filed against police and fire agencies for discrimination in recruiting.
Under Merrick Garland, DOJ sued police and fire departments in North Carolina, Georgia, Maryland, and Indiana, alleging written exams discriminated against black applicants and physical fitness tests disadvantaged female recruits.
ABC Stephen Portnoy. Elon Musk attending the first cabinet meeting of Trump's second term. This after his email demanding federal workers explain their jobs or be fired. Trump backing him up. And about those who haven't replied.
Those million people that haven't responded, though, Elon, they are on the bubble.
California Governor Gavin Newsom asking a parole board to launch an investigation into whether the Menendez brothers pose an unreasonable risk to the public if released could be the first step in commuting their sentences. The brothers have spent nearly 30 years in prison for killing their parents. Wall Street, the Dow down 188 points today. This is ABC News. A new warning for some.